Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Well, today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Lisa Fredrickson. She is the author of a new book titled Crossing the Line from Alcohol Use to Abuse to Dependence. This is a book that helps readers understand the steps that lead to alcohol dependency, also known as alcoholism. And there has been much breakthrough research done on the brain functions and how the brain becomes compromised with alcohol abuse. We're going to be talking about that as well. We will be addressing some myths and risk factors. But before I chat with Lisa, I'd like you to know a little bit about her. Lisa Fredrickson has been consulting, researching, writing, and speaking on substance abuse, addiction treatment, dual diagnosis, underage drinking, and help for the family centered around the 21st century brain and addiction-related research since 2003. Her 40 years plus experience with family and friends, alcohol abuse and alcoholism, her own recovery work, and her research for her most recent book, Crossing the Line from Alcohol Use to Abuse to Dependence, which we're going to be talking about today. She's also written If You Loved Me, You'd Stop, and Loved One in Treatment, Now What? Frame her work. She founded BreakingTheCycle.com in 2008 and writes a blog of the same name. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Irene. How are you?
I'm good. Gosh, this is going to be an interesting conversation. I can hardly wait to get into it. But before we do, just tell us, give us a brief synopsis of what your book, Crossing the Line from Alcohol Use to Abuse to Dependence, really is about.
As I found myself, in dealing with family members and friends who abuse or drink too much, I was always under the assumption that drinking was either normal or alcoholic, and so spent a great deal of time tolerating intolerable behaviors that occurred because of the drinking, all in fear of calling them an alcoholic or getting into the fight about you need help and what kind of help that might look like. So this book is an outcome of the research I've been doing since 2003 and my other books on my own experiences to help people try to understand that drinking is, you can have low-risk drinking, which is kind of what they call normal, at-risk drinking, which is that in-between period when people really start to engage in what I call drinking behaviors, because it's the behaviors that occur when they have more than the brain and body can process. And then there's alcohol dependence or alcoholism. And anywhere on that line, people can interrupt the progression. We don't have to go to alcoholism before we can get help, for example. So it was to just start conversations around debunking the common myths that cause people to move along that line and their drinking to get worse, not only for themselves, but for their family members and friends.
Well, and it's certainly a book that, you know, is going to reach and is reaching a lot of people because, as you say, there are a lot of myths. Now, first of all, maybe what we should I should comment on is you said normal, what you thought. You were living in this family and friends and so on, and the drinking was going on, and it was normal to you. And isn't it interesting how we, in our own perception, you know, it is normal. But all of a sudden, when we go get out of that situation and start getting educated and we're looking and observing, it's like, holy cow, this is not normal.
Oh, my gosh, yes. And it sort of like ekes up on you where they liken it to be a frog in a pot of water. And as it's slowly brought to a boil, the frog adapts to the temperature change and doesn't pop out. It's sort of that idea where it might start out binge drinking, you know, a couple times a month, maybe just heavy drinking on the weekends. And so you start saying, well, at least they go to work, or at least they're not mean, or at least they still, whatever the fill in the blank is. And so you accommodate these behaviors that are the consequence of alcohol in the brain while it waits for its time out the liver, and not understanding that's what you're dealing with. And so if that person changes their drinking pattern, you could stop that. And wouldn't that be nice?
Exactly. But, you know, and then you're saying the person changes the drinking pattern, but that also affects the rest of the family, not only as it did when the person was drinking, but all of a sudden they have changed, and then there's an issue for the family because that person that stopped drinking is not normal anymore.
Yes, that's so true, because you're all used to dealing, I kind of call it a dance, you're all used to doing a particular dance step, and suddenly somebody has changed that step, and if you don't learn it, you're going to be stepping on toes.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right, because everybody in a family dynamic, whether it's around alcohol, or it could be mental illness, or it could be an ill child, the way people react to the situation itself and then to each other's reactions around it are part of this dance. And so if the person drinking stops drinking and stops having these drinking behaviors, all that focus the family had on stopping the drinking and making them do it differently or whatever suddenly is sort of like airtime. Now what do we do with this?
No kidding, because things are different. And, you know, you had mentioned alcohol abuse and alcoholism. So what is the difference between the two?
Okay. Alcoholism is the brain disease of addiction, and it's one of the brain diseases of addiction. Others are to different illegal or prescription drugs or alcohol. And alcohol is a drug, but there's sometimes, you know, this attempt to distinguish between the two, like it's not as bad as heroin addiction. But addiction is addiction. It hijacks the way the brain works. So the alcohol abuse sets up the chemical and structural changes in the brain. And now with this imaging capability, people can actually see what this looks like. If a person crosses that invisible line from abuse to addiction, what happens then is their brain interprets, because of where it initially works in the limbic system and the pleasure-reward pathways, the brain interprets the substance as critical to survival because that's what those neural networks in that part of the brain were originally designed for the species. So to answer your question specifically, alcohol abuse is heavy social drinking, which is defined as repeatedly drinking more than the average of one standard drink a day for women or two standard drinks a day for men, or repeated binge drinking. And that's defined for women as four or more on occasion, or five or more for men. So what we kind of accommodate for a long period of time in there is quote-unquote normal drinking, because everybody does it, depending on our sphere of, you know, if it's in college or if it's with coworkers or whatever, what we think of as normal, or at least not alcoholic. That's where the changes start to come, and that's a person who is abusing alcohol but has not crossed the line to addiction is capable of changing their drinking patterns, coming back to low-risk drinking, and not having these drinking behavior experiences. A person who is an alcoholic, however, they now have embedded addiction-related brain maps, and if they drink at all, it will go back in, kick those brain maps, and that's why it's also a relapsing disease. The brain tricks itself with the memories and the patterns, the embedded brain maps around all things in the addiction, and thinks, you know, it's been 30 days. This is why oftentimes relapse happens. They come out of rehab, they're clean maybe for another couple weeks, and then they think, you know, gosh, I haven't been having anything for 6 weeks. I can do it. And they have a drink, but they go back in and kick those embedded brain maps, and it's different.
Well, it certainly takes longer. It's been 6 weeks to train the brain.
It really does, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because you're healing the brain, and so long-term recovery requires, you know, not only stopping the drinking, but you're going to have to come up with what you did instead of the drinking. And so,
yes.
And addressing the cues that triggered the drinking. So it's a very complex problem, and oftentimes we just think, oh, well, stop drinking, go to some meetings and do drug testing, and that should do it. Well, you have to help the person deal with the fallout, new relationships, new ways of relating, not necessarily new relationships.
Well, in many cases, it is new relationships.
Well, that's
no longer those relationships, the drinking relationships, work anymore.
You're right. Yeah. It's pretty complicated. And yet, this is what's interesting, is a disease by its simplest definition is something that changes cells in a negative way.
Uh-huh.
This one happens to change cells in the brain, because the brain controls everything we think, feel, say, and do. That's what changes a person's behaviors. Now, healing other diseases, as a society, we expect that after you do the stabilization and the acute care, so you go in, you maybe do surgery, you do some chemo or whatever, then we expect that there's a long continuing care where we come back in, we visit again, we say, how's that going? Okay, that part didn't work. Let's up this. We're going to change your, you know, that type of thing. With substance abuse treatment, it's often 28 days, you should be good to go, and why aren't
right.
you? It's
yes.
your fault. Instead of a continuing care of, boy, how are we going to, I mean, and it's more than just stopping drinking. They now understand, again, with this research, that nutrition helps the brain. Sleep helps the brain. Actually, the neurons and the neural networks and exercise. So people can be doing those kinds of activities, too, just to sort of, it's just as if we were suddenly changing, taking care of our body and be eating health more healthily. Not only is it good for the body, now they understand these activities are very good for brain health.
Yeah, and isn't it great that there's research actually, well, interest, first of all, to even do the research.
Yeah.
I understand, Lisa, too, that one of the main signs of alcoholism is blackouts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and I don't know that it's a main sign, but it's definitely a sign because people can be binge drinkers and blackout as well.
Yeah.
So, and blackouts, I remember myself thinking, what do you mean you don't remember what you did last night? You were there talking to me because they're there. They're acting.
Yeah.
I mean, not acting like in a movie, but they're engaging with you, and you think, how in the world can you say you don't remember?
Mm-hmm.
But now they understand that it's when the brain is overwhelmed, if you will, a person cannot slot into long-term memory the actions, and so they actually do have a full or a fragmentary blackout. And this is something that people, one of the myths, is that not understanding that eating a big meal or drinking water is going to dilute or absorb the alcohol.
It doesn't?
No.
Oh.
Well, yeah, that's because we don't understand how alcohol is processed by the body.
Uh-huh.
So it's not processed through the digestive system like other foods and liquids. Instead, it passes through the stomach into the small intestine and immediately moves into the bloodstream and from there travels to body tissue high in water content and highly vascularized like the brain. It is only processed or metabolized by the body through enzymes in the liver. So it takes the liver on a very rough average about 1 hour to metabolize or rid the body of the alcohol in one standard drink. So a person drinking 5, 6, 7 drinks, it's 5, 6, 7 hours till it leaves their body. In the meantime, it sits in these body organs and body tissue high in water content and highly vascularized like the brain. And that's what starts to suppress brain function. And so when you're to your point of blackout, if somebody's, you know, drinking like on a 21st birthday and they drink 21 shots, which is sometimes a popular game, that's just overwhelming to the whole system.
No kidding.
And they're not an alcoholic.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Yeah. And that's the danger of this with people is to try and understand what you do in that blackout or what you could be life-changing. And, I mean, look at the Secret Service with President Obama.
Yes.
I mean, they're probably not alcoholics, many of them, but holy smokes, this is a drinking scandal.
Exactly.
Not just a sex scandal.
Yeah. I agree.
They wouldn't have done that probably had they not had that much to drink.
Yeah, exactly. And as we know, you know, and that is such a good example because when it hits the brain, we cannot think properly. You know, we're irrational, make irrational decisions. It's like, you know, people that have had too much to drink still think that they can drive.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. And so, and it's because the part, the rational part of the brain, the cerebral cortex, and that is gone. I mean, not gone. I don't mean gone, but I mean
it's drunk.
So compromised, right, that it can't. So you stand up and you go, I feel fine. I'm good to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think it's helpful for others in a person's sphere of influence to know that this whole thing. So if they see a friend, say, drinking a couple margaritas at the bar after work on happy hour, knowing that your typical bar pour, like a margarita, often has more than one standard drink.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're having a couple margaritas, they've really had 4 standard drinks. Well, that is more than the body can handle to go drive.
Yeah.
So you then yourself go, you know what, I'm not going to drive with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to make sure that he comes with me. No matter how much you think they are safe to drive, they really aren't, because it takes 4 hours to get four drinks out the liver. And so all food does is slows how quickly it passes through the stomach. It doesn't absorb it, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing about it is important to eat. I don't take that away, but that's just so it doesn't immediately get to the brain. And then that's once it's in the brain, you start to lose that capability of going, eh, I better not have another and drive, or you know,
right.
I better not have another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's, and then the idea of water is more just to help with the dehydration, because alcohol dehydrates us, yeah.
So one of the other myths, from what I understand, is sleeping it off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I hear this, or I've heard it a lot, that, I'll feel much better when I sleep it off.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really a myth.
Right. Depending on how much a person has had to drink, when they sleep it off, quote unquote, it suppresses their central nervous system, which is, you know, part of our breathing, and heartbeat is part of that system. So you have to be very careful when a friend has that much that they pass out, because they could die.
Yeah.
And it's not just roll them over on their side and so that, you know, they, you know, prop them up on the side of the back so that they puke that way.
Mm-hmm.
You have to monitor them for breathing, and you know, to make sure that they're going to make it through this. So because again, it takes the liver about an hour to process, you know, standard drink. And this is the other part. Young people's brains, because of the brain development that's going on from 12 to 25, and again, this is research we just didn't know till, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, until we had these imaging capabilities to study the brain. But it's not the adult brain. And so it behaves differently with alcohol. It's less susceptible to passing out, but it's more susceptible to the reasoning part, to the effects on alcohol on the reasoning part. So to think that we're just teaching kids how to drink, or this is just a rite of passage that all kids should go through, is really a disservice to them. And yes, many of us drank early and made it out. Most young people do. But again, it's that idea of what could happen in that time period when you do something that you never would have done sober, you know. And then also to understand that underage drinking is the key risk factor for developing alcoholism because of the brain development that's going on at that time.
It's also said that alcoholism is genetic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like
right.
you to address that, too.
Sure. That's one of the five key risk factors. And what it is we have about 25,000 genes in our DNA that all kind of come together at once to make us who we are. Many of them are inherited, your predisposition to certain cancers or eye color or certain disease or hair color or height.
Uh-huh.
So there's not an addiction gene, per se, that they've identified, but it could be higher or lower levels of the enzyme in the liver that breaks down the alcohol, or it could be higher or lower levels of dopamine or dopamine receptors. Or there's many ways that people are genetically predisposed in a family to the impacts of alcohol. That's one. The next one is early use being the number one. Then there's mental illness, because oftentimes people with a mental illness like depression or anxiety or post-traumatic stress will drink because it works in the pleasure-reward pathways. That's why we drink, by the way. It starts there in those pathways. And if we did not feel a pleasurable feeling for drinking, we likely wouldn't do it, because it would be about as much pleasure as drinking water. We might remind ourselves, I have to have three more glasses today, instead
right.
of, where are my three glasses of water?
Uh-huh.
And so they'll self-medicate the mental illness with alcohol, and you know, so that's the third one.
Uh-huh.
Fourth one is childhood trauma, which can be verbal, physical, or emotional abuse, or sexual assault,
uh-huh.
or abuse, because, again, that changes the child's brain. The ability to look at something with a reasoning and say, okay, that's their problem, they did it to me, it's not me, comes when you're an adult, when the brain goes through that developmental stage, 16, 18, 20, that area. not when you're 9, 10, 11, 12. So that changes the way a person's brain goes together. And then the last one is social environment. If you grow up or you're in a setting like college or high school where everybody drinks, or that's the perception, or they drink heavily and you say, well, that's how we drink, so that's how I'll drink. If it doesn't work with your brain, you're going to be drinking at a level that you're that doesn't work with your brain. And so kind of thinking of it more holistically, certain people have certain diseases and it doesn't work to do certain things when they're specific. So it doesn't make you a bad person. It's just looking at this pattern in your family and looking at it then in yourself and going, wow, you know, we've got 3 out of the 4. I better, you know, really watch it. Not to become, I'm going to have a drink and become an alcoholic, but I've got to be very careful. And if I don't find myself able to control it, I should probably really think differently about this whole thing in the beginning. And this is something often, too, we don't understand. We go after underage drinking sort of in high school. But you know what? If you grow up in a family with active alcohol abuse or alcoholism, you've got genetics. You've got childhood trauma. You've got often mental illness in the form of anxiety or depression. And then you have social environment. So there are 4 out of the 5 key risk factors before you as a young person even take your first drink. So we really need to come at this issue, and that's what this book is. One of the ways I'm hoping to help that is for parents as they're reading this to see if there's a pattern like this in their family. Wow, all of this contributes. We need to deal with this back here and talk to the children about it in our family, or make different decisions about how we're going to drink in our family, you know. And so, and oftentimes the child trying to cope in a family gets that emotional illness too, because your coping skills are based on how you're, like you said in the very beginning, dealing with the other people in the family.
Oh, and that's...
Sorry, I get so going on.
Oh, I understand. I understand that. You're passionate about this.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Lisa Fredrickson, author of Crossing the Line from Alcohol Use to Abuse to Dependence. Hey, hasn't this been an interesting conversation so far? I bet you think it is. So please do listen in for the rest of it, because there's going to be so much more.
Yeah.
You mentioned self-medication, and I know that alcohol or any other drugs really are often used by people as medicators for, you know, emotional issues that they have. And this often results, you know, rather than taking, let's say, if they're in depression, rather than taking medication or using some other form of correction of that, they will self-medicate with alcohol.
Correct.
Because, as we know, what happens when you drink, you know, everything is suppressed and we feel better.
Right, because initially you're going into that pleasure-reward pathway and it feels good, and and then oftentimes you sort of forget your problems. You know, that part can go on too. And that's why it's such an issue for the military, coming home with post-traumatic stress or just, and then their family.
Yes.
You know, and so that's the big part that's often missing in the discussion is the family who is dealing with this stuff, because the presumption is you stop the drinking and everybody's fine.
Yeah.
Well,
we
need to recognize the impacts on everybody and treat this as a holistic unit that needs help.
That's right. It's not. This is a family disease.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an individual disease.
Absolutely.
And that family is actually goes to extended family plus friends.
Yes, absolutely. You're right.
And you know, support is so, so important. And that goes back to when you had talked about relationships, and I made a comment that, you know, sometimes relationships have to change too.
Mm-hmm.
Because once the person is out of treatment, if that's the way they choose to go or however they choose to stop, those drinking buddies don't fit anymore.
Right.
And the
right.
thing is, too, the family sometimes don't fit, too. So the person
yeah.
has to make a big choice. And
they
that's
sure
not
do.
Easy because then there are abandonment issues that come up. And, you know, with issues like abandonment, it's back to drinking.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, you're so right. And, you know, and if the family doesn't get help, then they tend to go after the recovery the same way they were going after the drinking.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in there, have you gone to a meeting? You better go to a meeting or whatever. The
Right, right.
And as you said, there are so many ways to get sober. It's not
yeah.
just one way. And I think, like you mentioned, that's so important that people understand that there are many options. And that's also covered in the book as one of the myths, that it's not just AA is the only way. Or you know.
Yes.
But if the family doesn't understand, and that's where I'm hoping, sorry, I start and then I go off into another is if we can understand how alcohol hijacks the brain, which is in that book, we can help them understand how healing the brain, and it hijacks the brain of the family member too, because we get stuck in the emotion of anxiety and fear, also part of the limbic system, where we're reacting to the feeling that is pretty prevalent in a family when there's active drinking and drinking behaviors, such as, well, what if he picks up the kid, or what if she, you know, stops after work, or what if he doesn't stay sober when we go to the company function, I'm going to lose my job, you know, blah, blah,
yeah.
blah, blah. That anxiety, the family stays in there, and if they don't understand how to break that pattern, that automatic reaction to the emotion, then they're going to kind of go after, oh, I wonder if he's staying sober. I wonder if he's going to go to a drink. He's been gone for 2 hours. I think he might have stopped. You know, that
yeah,
kind of
yeah.
thing. And that sets up a dynamic that, again, you perpetuate the lack of trust. And, yeah, so it's both everybody needs help. And, and I'm hoping, and this book is very short. It's just 80 pages, intentionally short, to help people get into this quickly and out of it if the parts don't relate to them. But this bigger picture, because it is a progression, it is a line, and anywhere on that line, we don't have to hit bottom, or somebody doesn't have to, you know, be out on the street homeless and then get help. Family members can act differently. They can see this as a brain change. Oh, how am I going to deal with a brain that's substancing? I can't make that brain different. I have to do something different myself, whether that brain gets sober or not. You see what I mean? It's a whole different
yes.
dynamic.
Yes, it ends up being about us, the family
right.
or the friend. We have to make the choices,
right.
and we have to make the changes.
Right, and when we stop nagging and blaming and shaming, that person's left with just their behaviors, and then they have to start looking at the source of the behaviors. Gosh, it is the drinking, you know, so I better get this under control. And oftentimes people just don't even know what low-risk drinking is. I myself, I was surprised to understand what a standard drink was, but people continually in my work are surprised. You mean a 5-ounce glass of wine is the same as 1.5 ounces of bourbon? Yep, that's the same alcohol, you know.
Yeah.
Or 3.3 ounces of champagne compared to 5 ounces of wine.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even know where we're aiming.
Yeah.
What yeah. is the target here?
Tell me again, you said earlier as we were talking, what is the standard per day again?
So what it is low-risk drinking for women is 7 standard drinks in a week with no more than 3 of the 7 on any one day. So that's where the idea of a standard drink per day,
okay.
or it could be, you know, 2 days of one drink
right.
and then 2 days of...
But no more than 7.
But no, right, but no more than 7 total. And what that gets at is low-risk drinking not only for... avoiding, so you don't save all 7 for Saturday and drink them all at once and then say, well, I'm moderate because I only had 7.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the 3 or more, or 3, you know, no more than 3 in a day.
In a day, right.
Right, to keep, avoid binge drinking. And so theoretically to keep you in control of your brain and your behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it for women. And then it's also for caloric intake.
Oh, sure.
Every alcoholic drink has about 100 calories, some more. But then there's, you know, very... there is nutritional value, but it's not the kind of nutritional value we need for optimum body health. So if somebody's drinking 3-4 drinks, that's 300-400 calories, and oftentimes then you'll lose the resolve to not eat the cheese and the crackers.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't really care about making dinner, heck.
Yeah, right.
Pizza. And so that's part of it. So for women, it's 7 standard drinks in a week, no more than 3 of those 7 in a day. And for men, it's 14 standard drinks in a week.
Really?
No more than 4 of the 14 in a day. Mm-hmm. Often because men tend to weigh more.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's one of the influencing. So when I mention that hour, it depends on, you know, stress. It depends on body weight. It depends on other medications. So it can be less than an hour or more than an hour, depending on many variables, but people should at least keep in mind that it's about an hour a standard drink. And a standard drink now, then, is a regular beer, a 12-ounce regular beer. When you get to the malt liquors, it's less, or the malt, you know, those heavy beers. It's 1.5 ounces of bourbon vodka, and again, 80 proof, not 151 rum, because that's double, so then it would be 3/4 of an ounce, for example. 3.3 ounces of champagne, and 5 ounces of regular wine. So all of those have the same amount of alcohol. And so what's helpful is for people to pour them into their favorite size drinking glass and measure it and see what it looks like. Because if you're pouring in this glass and you're pouring in this glass, a glass of wine is going to be 2 different things.
Right. You know?
And when you're at a party and oftentimes it's the cocktail hour and they keep coming by and filling the glass, you have to really, no thank you, finish it so that you know you've had one drink, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So once it's poured in the amount that you know is 5 ounces, don't let them refill your glass, because all of that is what starts to compromise brain function and then think, you know, well, I think I only had a couple and I'm good to whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be aware, if you're going to a party, to plan how much you're going to drink and to stick within that limit, and then you should be able to stay in control of your brain.
Right, and that's important.
And that's the object.
Lisa, this is just something that sort of is puzzling me. And, okay, so we're talking about 7 drinks per week for women and 14 for men. And as I'm thinking in my mind, okay, so women coming home from work, you know, it's been stressful, they've been in rush hour traffic, so on, and it's important for them to have that glass of wine or whatever to relax before they go ahead and make dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't that a medicator then, if there's a reason?
That's a good question.
You know, because I'm thinking that if there's all of a sudden a reason, because I need to relax before I make dinner or deal with the kids,
yeah,
or whatever, then to me, I don't know if this is kind of crossing the line.
Well, I know what you're saying, and it is certainly sending a message to the children that alcohol is what I need to relax.
Yeah.
Which is a problem. It's also sending a message to yourself that alcohol is what you need to relax. Now, if you stay within just that one standard drink, you know, 5 ounces of wine, and you don't pour another one while you're making dinner and then one with dinner,
mm-hmm,
you see, then that you're staying within low-risk drinking limits. But oftentimes what happens is you have that one, then it's easy to pour another one because now you're making dinner,
yeah,
and you're starting to feel better. And then you pour a third with dinner because you just have a glass of wine with the meal.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've had 3, and you're having 21 in a week, and that's you know, more than even at-risk drinking.
Yes, exactly.
It's defined as repeatedly having more than the alcohol abuse or at-risk drinking is trying to get at both the daily or the binge weekend binge drinking. So that's why it's repeatedly having more than one a day,
yeah.
If you choose it that way,
right.
Or it's repeatedly binge drinking, which is, you know, I mean, because a lot of times people will, on an occasion, I mean, like a rare occasion, have maybe 3 or more.
Sure.
Which makes them an alcoholic, and that's where the
right
idea of the repeated, because you're changing your brain by the brain, as you were just mentioning, you start to get a brain map around, I come home and then I pour my glass of wine and then I'm okay. It,
yeah.
it,
Yeah.
You know, and what we need to think of with these brain maps is an expression, neurons that fire together, wire together. So the cells in our brain control and talk to all the other cells in our body. And they become then automatic behaviors because they're repetitively activated. So one I like to use as an example is brushing your teeth. If you ever were to try to brush with your non-dominant hand, what you would have to do to change that behavior is probably put the toothpaste in the bedroom so that when you went to grab for it, you would go, oh, yeah, that's right, I'm changing hands.
Right.
That's just brushing our teeth.
Yeah.
That's an embedded brain map that's just around the behavior that we've repeated over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
So if we repeat the behavior of every time I get home, I have to have that glass of wine, we start to anticipate. We start to get anxious if, you know, we don't have wine. We might actually go out of the way to the store to get the wine to have that glass of wine. Do you really want something controlling your behaviors that much? You know, again, thinking of it as water, would you come home and, gosh, I have to have a glass of water?
Yeah, right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, we might want to look at something that becomes that embedded to be very careful that it doesn't, we don't start to kid ourselves that, you know, a couple's okay, you know. Okay,
yeah.
one to relax and then one with dinner.
Well,
and
then it's restoration.
Right. I remember a swim meet going to with my daughter. She was in fourth grade, and it was one of these where they had alcohol at the swim meet, and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and this little girl comes running up to her mom, and she had to be around 9 because she was in my daughter's swim team.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she said, Mommy, Mommy, it's okay. They have your wine here. So this little girl knew her mother needed, and the mom said, she goes, oh, she knows I like my glass of wine, and didn't bat an eye. And then you're thinking, and now you're going to drive the child home. So there you're giving two mixed messages, one, I need it to watch your swim meet, and then I'm driving you home, but don't believe me when I tell you, don't drink and drive, or believe me and don't, you know.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, it's just alcoholism and alcohol abuse and just alcohol in general, you know, when abused, this is really, it's a dangerous disease.
It is. It really is. Because it's one that's so acceptable in our culture.
Yes.
I mean, look at those Secret Servicemen. As you read the articles about it, it's an accepted practice.
Yeah.
And not just them. I mean, my gosh, it's in so many cultures. It's often in business culture where you're expected to go out after and, you know, have a few drinks or...
Well, that's why they have happy hours.
Yes!
They used to be Friday. Now they're extending them to Thursday and Friday.
Yes, and the thing that's so absurd is you get a bunch of people drinking cheap drinks and then they all die.
Yes.
You're like, what is wrong with this picture?
No kidding.
It'd be one thing if we lived on transit lines where you could just climb on.
And hope you get off at the right stop.
Yeah, that's true. Don't do anything in the meantime.
Right.
Yeah. No, and that's where, and so often drinking is never intentionally, the progression is never intentional. And that's what I hope comes through in the book, too, is that this, what you were just mentioning, if you always go to happy hour on Thursday and Friday, you will anticipate happy hour on Thursday and Friday. And the thought of not going to happy hour on Thursday and Friday because you're on a camping trip up in the mountains.
Yes.
You can't handle it, you know, so you backpack in the wine.
Yeah.
Well, that sort of defeats the purpose. So it's just kind of being aware that anything in our life that starts to run how we live it, is that something we, you know, maybe we want to take a look at it.
Well said. It is so true. And I think that's where we're going to stop it at that. And
okay.
So, Lisa, tell our listening audience your website address.
Okay. It's breakingthecycles.com. And oftentimes people will just go breaking the cycle, but it's breaking the cycles with an S, breakingthecycles.com.
Great.
Yeah.
And listeners, hasn't this been great? I tell you, Lisa is just so full of information. I think we could probably talk for a whole day on this. I mean, you've obviously know this topic. And listeners, the name of the book is Crossing the Line from Alcohol Use to Abuse to Dependence. And as Lisa had mentioned, this is a really important book for parents as well, because especially if they have children that are growing up or teens that are, you know, wanting to experiment, and teens will experiment. The thing is, too, Lisa, from my understanding, I think that the average age of kids starting to drink is something like 9.
I've heard that one, and frankly haven't locked that in, but my understanding was more like 11-12, but I have heard that 9.
Yeah, I think that's more recent.
And I just recently, yeah. But like I said, I hadn't quite locked that year in, but...
I mean, that is scary.
Yeah,
this is darn scary. So, listeners, do check this book out. And, you know, I just really encourage you to just sit back and reflect. Is there somebody in your family or a friend that maybe sort of is on the edge and maybe it's time to really look at it? And yourself, too. You know, are you having one drink too many? Are you past the standard? So I really encourage you to go to Lisa's website. Again, it's breakingthecycles.com. And check out the information she has on there. And also this book, Crossing the Line from Alcohol Abuse to Dependence. And again, we're talking to Lisa Fredrickson. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you so much, Irene. I really, really appreciate the opportunity.
And this is Irene Watson for Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.